This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canada's top Native leader says police across the country should be prepared to accept some of the blame for the nationwide investigation into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
Perry Bellegarde is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. He told the Association of Police Chiefs to expect some fingers pointed at them. Bellegarde says they failed by not putting enough human and financial resources into investigating cases involving First Nations women. And he says police forces should begin compiling their statistics now and thinking about the issue. And Bellegarde says they need to be big enough to show that more work needs to be done to improve policing.
How many of them have strategic plans in place regarding First Nations recruitment and retention within their systems? How many of them have community advisory boards? So don't wait for anything from an inquiry. There's things that we can do now to help work towards ending violence in our communities.
A recent report suggested law enforcement should address delays in responding to reports about missing Indigenous women and girls. It also says police should address systemic racism and look at how officers treat Indigenous women and their families. At least one police chief said some of the criticism is justified, and the coming inquiry will lay some of the controversy to rest or it will hold some people accountable. But he also said a lot has changed over the past 10 years in the way police handle such cases. They no longer wait 24 hours to start a missing persons file. They work more closely with families, and they put safeguards in place so that cases don't fall through the cracks. A monument to missing and murdered Indigenous women is being built in front of police headquarters in Saskatoon. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Tribes are among those who've long voiced their concerns about fuel transportation through the Columbia River Gorge. Those concerns have been heightened after the recent oil train derailment in the Pacific Northwest. As reporter Emily Schwing tells us, during press briefings, spokespeople from the Union Pacific Railroad and officials from various government agencies answered questions, but no one was present to speak about the concerns of tribes.
Officials from Oregon and Washington State, as well as federal agents, do say they're working with tribes to make sure resources, like Columbia River salmon, are protected from oil spilled during the accident. Lana Jack, who grew up in Celilo Village, 30 miles up the Columbia River, was among the 100 or so citizens that gathered for an anti-oil train rally in Hood River last weekend.
So our connection to this river is huge. It's our lifeline. There's probably no really other way of putting it, whether it be the salmon or all that the water provides.
The train derailment happened at the start of a weekend during which tribal members gathered to commemorate the signing of an 1855 treaty between the U.S. government and 14 bands that make up the Yakama Nation. Elizabeth Sanchi is the nation's environmental manager.
I speak for those things that can't speak for themselves, our fisheries, our water, our land, our air, and we're at risk right now, and it is very disheartening.
Sanchi says the Yakama Nation has been included in the response to the train derailment. She says the cleanup effort must be immediate. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing in Hood River, Oregon.
Seven names have been selected for a new Native American Hall of Honor in North Dakota. The first recipients include those in sports, military, leadership, and the arts. The Native American Hall of Honor will recognize people annually who've been outstanding in representing their tribe and culture. The program is a partnership of the state's Indian Affairs Commission, Historical Society, and the Historical Society Foundation. And it will be located in the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum in Bismarck. Information and objects relating to each inductee will be featured in an annual exhibit at the museum. The induction ceremony is planned for September. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Navajo Nation Bar Association to the Albuquerque Sheraton Uptown June 9th and 10th. Information on convention and tourism services at siabq.org. That's siabq.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service. It's 6 minutes past here, and you are tuned to a Juno Afternoon. Our first guest is Lyle Hebert, longtime Juno filmmaker. He's just working on a new movie that's just been released, Earrock. Lyle, thanks for being on the show with me today.
Sure, Jeff.
So, what does the title refer to?
Earrock, the way of the human being.
And what does that revolve around?
What it is, Earrock's kind of a way of... It is a way of being for the Yupik people, Yupik and Chupik people in western Alaska. It's like a code of living, kind of like the Bible is for Christians. You know, it's the way they behave and look at the world.
What's the basic storyline of the movie?
Basically, it is what life was like before the coming of westernization. When they were in harmony with their environment, when they had like spiritual explanations for everything, when their medicine worked, and then after the arrival of the white man, they got infected with the Spanish influenza of 1918. They died in massive death, and they called it Great Death, and they lost faith in themselves and their culture. You know, the white man's medicine worked and theirs didn't, so it kind of undermined their whole faith in their culture.
What inspired you to start the movie?
Well, I read this essay years ago by Harold Napoleon, who's Yupik from Hooper Bay, and I was very moved by it. And I just wanted to make a good film, and the best way to do that is find a good subject. And the essay has a lot of heart in it, and poetry and profundity, and I thought that would be a very good topic. It also applies to Native Americans, I think, throughout the northern and southern hemisphere.
Wouldn't you call this a big budget movie?
No, it wasn't. You know, I got like $15,000 matching funds from Rasmussen, but then crowdfunded it with a ton of help from the people in Juneau, a lot of old friends. And then people on Kickstarter and Indiegogo chipped in. And so we came up with, and Pete Metcalf and Sharon Gateman and Tim Metcalf, a fundraiser here. And we came up with, you know, I think it was about $40,000. And the film itself runs about 28 minutes long. So it's it's nothing I made a ton of money on by any means, but I wasn't making it for money. And so it was just kind of a low budget film.
Who's in the film?
Pardon me?
Who's in the film?
Well, there's probably Yari Walker, who's a Yupik Eskimo from Savunga. Then there's Kelsey Wallace, who works at the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage. She's Yupik. There's some members of Harold Napoleon's family. There are Houston Laws, who's a local guy who used to work with the hospital, plays a part of a missionary. And then there's some kind of cameo parts for like Larry Golden and Bill Parker. Then everybody else in it, Aussie, I have a hard time pronouncing his last name, but he's Karulak. I think that's kind of like you pronounce it. He's got this Yupik dance group up there. He and the dancers were in it, and there were a lot of people. Basically, Megan Napoleon, with the help of Larry, put together a whole bunch of people up there who are Yupik or Inupiat to be in the film. So almost everybody in it is Eskimo.
Can you tell me who was Harold Napoleon?
Harold Napoleon was a young Native leader back in the 70s, and he grew up in Hooper Bay, and he's the author of the film.
Wouldn't you say there's a message in the film?
Oh, yeah, I definitely would.
And what's that message?
Well, the message is, you know, in a nutshell, the way I look at it is, how would you feel if somebody came into, like, say, the United States, and they were different race, different set of values, and just started telling you what to do, and basically took control of things. And then on top of that, you got some illness which your people weren't immune to, and like thousands of people died, you know, villages were wiped out. I mean, how would you feel if that happened to you? And that's basically the message. Plus, the second part of the film, the first part's a reenactment. The second part is composed of three or four interviews with people, Yupik people, on life today. And, you know, more about Yurok and what it means and how there is strength and hope there.
Well, what were some of the challenges you had to go through to make the film?
Basically, other than raising the money, the biggest challenge is I've got ALS, all right, so I'm getting weaker all the time, so I was kind of racing from the Reaper, you know, to try to get this film done. And so I had to kind of move fast, you know, and thank God that we're able to raise enough money so I could start moving fast. Like in October is when we shot most of it up in Anchorage and Chivac. And I was out on the tundra with a stroller, you know, kind of hopping around with a stroller, you know, not really able to walk very well. Well, we got it done. We got had some good crew in it, like Gabe Strong here in Juneau. He was my main camera guy, you know. And then Pat Race helped out. George Couhard did some really nice music for it. You know, we had a lot of, you know, good people work on this thing.
I'm talking to Lyle Hebert, who's the filmmaker of Yurok. Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah, Yurok.
When is it going to be shown? When can people see it?
Well, 360 North is going to show it on the 28th of this month. That's a Tuesday night at 8 p.m. throughout the state. And it's going to be showing, I believe, down at Goldtown. Might be showing right now. I'm not sure. But they showed it a few weeks ago, and they're talking about showing it during celebration, too. So it's, and also after I get it out on 360 North, I'll probably put it on YouTube. And we're also, you know, selling DVDs if anybody wants a DVD of it or a Blu-ray.
All right, I've been talking with Lyle Hebert, filmmaker. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, but, you know, you guys helped out with the recording, you know, and I really appreciate that, you know, recording the narration, you know, and and thanks for getting me on your show.
Wow, yeah. Thank you so much for being on the air.
Sure. Have a good day, pal.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 8th of June, 2016.
The birthday of Frank Lloyd Wright, born Richland Center, Wisconsin, 1867, led a long life, died in 1959. His mentor was the architect Louis Sullivan, who coined the saying, form follows function. Wright seemed to believe that form and function should be as one. His designs inspired the Prairie School architects, designing buildings that complemented, even seemed part of, nature. He liked natural materials, wood and stone, never painted them, horizontal designs, low roof lines so that the buildings blended in with the landscape, incorporated walls made almost entirely of windows to bring the outdoors indoors. Glass walls that were also functional, using winter sunlight to help heat the house. It's the birthday of the editor who is given credit for ushering in the golden age of science fiction, John W. Campbell, born Newark, 1910. His father was an electrical engineer. The boy was interested in science growing up, started writing science fiction when he was 18, when he was a student at MIT. Wrote a novella early on called Who Goes There, about a group of researchers in Antarctica discover an alien buried in the ice that has the ability to inhabit the body of anyone it attacks, to such a degree that it's impossible for the researchers to recognize which of them are still themselves and which are now aliens. It was made into a movie called The Thing back in 82. But his great contribution to science fiction was as an editor of the magazine Astounding Science Fiction from 1937 on. It was John Campbell who wanted science fiction to be based on real science. He championed writers like Isaac Asimov and Robert A. Heinlein, Theodore Sturgeon. He wanted stories in which scientists acted the way scientists do and engineers the way engineers do, and that the scientific culture be represented accurately. Isaac Asimov remembered John W. Campbell as a tall, large man with light hair, a beaky nose, a wide face with thin lips, a cigarette in a holder clamped between his teeth. He was talkative, opinionated, quicksilver-minded, overbearing. Here's a poem for today by Wendy Cope, From June to December, Summer Villanelle. You know exactly what to do, your kiss, your fingers on my thigh. I think of little else but you. It's bliss to have a lover who, touching one shoulder, makes me sigh. You know exactly what to do. You make me happy through and through, the way the sun lights up the sky. I think of little else but you. I hardly sleep an hour or two. I can't eat much, and this is why. You know exactly what to do. The movie in my mind is blue as June runs into warm July. I think of little else but you. But is it love, and is it true? Who cares? This much I can't deny. You know exactly what to do. I think of little else but you. From June to December, Summer Villanelle by Wendy Cope. From Making Cocoa for Kingsley Amis, published by Faber and Faber, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into challenging games. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by the Poetry Foundation, you can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 20 minutes past here on your 10-2 junior afternoon. Our next guest is on the telephone with us again. I'm talking about Midnight Sun Basketball. Joe Tompkins is on the air. Hi, Joe. Thanks for being on the show with us today. So, can you give me an overview of baseball in Alaska?
Excuse me?
Can you give me an overview of baseball in Alaska?
An overview of baseball? What do you mean? What would you like? What it takes? What we're doing?
Yeah.
Well, actually, Andy McCauley started up a Legion program here in Juneau, and then he retired, and I took over, and now what it consists of is all the Juneau boys aged between 15 and 19, all the top guys, and then we go play all over the state of Alaska. So we are in Legion, and they travel to us, and we travel to them, and I guess Ketchikan is the only other Southeast team, us and Ketchikan.
How many teams are there?
That I do not know. I'm so new. There's probably, in our division, probably 12. And maybe there's like two divisions, so like 20, maybe 24 teams, something like that. That's just a guess, total guess. I mean, I don't know.
What's your season look like?
Well, it starts off Friday with a single game, and then we have a doubleheader on Saturday where all league games and then non-league games on Sunday. And we play South, which those guys took state for high school baseball. So it's pretty exciting to start off with the best team in the state.
And that's at the Adair Kennedy Baseball Field?
Yes, sir.
What's it like playing baseball when it's so late at night?
I think it's wonderful. Well, for us, I've never done it up here, but the boys will be doing it up here, and they have done it, and they enjoy it. Seem like get over a game. It's like, you know, when you go to a matinee and you get out and it's still light, you're like, oh, we got lots to do. That's what they do.
Cool. Does it cost money to watch?
No, it doesn't cost any money at all. It's all free. And if you have kids that want to learn baseball, that's the best baseball players in Juneau right now that will be playing. And you could be learning stuff from them. So it's a good thing to come watch and share with your child or even your daughter. I mean, they can learn just like if they're playing softball. So
what's the age range of the kids?
For Legion, it's 15 to 19 years old. So even after you graduate and you're still 18, if you go to college and play ball, you can come back and play one more year.
All right, anything you'd like to add?
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it a lot. I think it's good for the kids and it's good for the community. It's good for the kids to keep them busy and out playing the sport. And also they can get scholarships by playing ball and having the right people see them.
Do you have a website?
There is a website. I do not know. Like I tell you, I'm so new. They're redoing it. But I think it's right now it's Midnight Suns Legion Post 25 as far as I know.
All right. Thanks again, Joe, for being there with me today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time and what you do.
Troy Quinn and the Juno Symphony on June 11th and 12th at JDHS as we whisk you away to Hollywood. Come experience the sounds of the past 70 years of great movie scores, from such classics as Over the Rainbow to the epic Star Wars, as well as a nostalgic tribute to the film scores of Henry Mancini. Relive music of the big screen from the greatest Hollywood composers, including Alfred Newman, Ennio Morricone, and of course, John Williams. Tickets are at Hearthside, the Jack, JunoSymphony.org, and at the door. Come experience the Juno Symphony. Adventure awaits.
This is Bird Note. This staccato call tells us there's a yellow-billed cuckoo nearby. One of two species of cuckoos in the woodlands of North America. The yellow-billed lives in broadleaf forests throughout the east and riparian stands in the southwest. They were common breeding birds in the Pacific Northwest as late as the 1920s, but then they disappeared. Ornithologists still don't know why. The black-billed cuckoo is a more northerly species, living in dense woodland, even conifer forests. Cuckoos perch quietly and scan their surroundings for food. Hairy tent caterpillars, shunned by most birds, are often on their meal ticket. So, if you have an infestation of tent caterpillars, you might see one of these slender brown and white birds with long white-spotted tails. The cuckoo plucks a caterpillar from its tent and manipulates it back and forth in its bill, taking off many of the bothersome hairs. But some of them remain, and cuckoo stomachs are sometimes lined with these hairs. When the hairs are dense enough to prevent digestion, the entire stomach lining is cast off and regurgitated. Nature finds surprising ways to deal with problems. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Support comes from the Alaska Robotics Gallery, offering art that features narwhals, squid, and flying whales, located at 220 Front Street in downtown Juneau. More information at alaskarobotics.com.
I'm in the studio with Annie Bartholomew, who's working on a concert at the Tiny Post Office, Kindred Post, this Thursday night. Annie, thanks for being in there with me today.
Hey, Jeff.
So, it's a concert featuring how many acts?
Well, currently we have 5 confirmed, but we're adding more all the time. It's a Tiny Post Office concert. We're hosting with Kindred Post, also the Trickster Company, and it's happening during Celebration. So we thought it was appropriate to bring in a bunch of really cool Alaska Native artists who are going to be there. And it's all part of a film series that we're doing here at KTOO. We did the red carpet concerts up at the Alaskan during Folk Fest. And now we get to do more artists in Rico and Christie's studio. So pretty excited to make this happen.
What time does it start?
It starts at 6. Doors open at 6:30. Concert starts at 7. 6:30 is really important because they fill up really fast. And, you know, it can get to standing room only pretty quickly. If it comes to a line, elders will be seated first at 6:30.
Who's playing?
It's not just music. We didn't want to keep it as strictly that. So there's going to be storytelling from Cody and Cody, also Lily Hope. Stephen Blanchett of Humua is going to be there doing some solo stuff. Really excited about Silver Jackson, a.k.a. Nick Glannon, with OC Notes, really cool artist from Home Skillet label. And Kendi Sean Austin is doing this really awesome pop and lock dancing. So we're not limiting it just to music, but lots of different modes of expression by contemporary Alaska Native artists.
That starts, doors open at 6:30. The show starts at 7 o'clock at the Kindred Post. Where's the Kindred Post located?
It's on South Franklin, I believe, right across from the Big Clock. It's a really small space, but it really lends itself to these really intimate, kind of quiet concerts. It's open to everyone, all ages, pay as you can. Don't let money keep you from coming to this really cool event. And like I said, they're all pretty intimate concerts. Can't find a better show in Juneau.
All right, Annie, thanks a lot for coming by. Anything you'd like to add?
just that we're really excited to work with Kindred Post and the Trickster Company, especially during Celebration. These are really incredible artists that I admire, and I think it'll be a memorable experience for everybody. And stay tuned for the videos. They should come out after Celebration, and we'll have a release schedule coming up.
All right. Thanks a lot, Annie. Music of Silver Jackson is performing along with a number of other people this Thursday at a concert at the Kindred Post. Doors open at 6:30. Concert starts at 7 o'clock, and the word is to get there early. Thank you. Steel Drum Kind of Day. That's the Santa Cruz Steel Band. Our next guest in the studio is Robert Barr, director of the Juno Library. He's here to talk about a workshop coming up on how to run for public office. Robert, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. I'm really happy to be here.
So this is the second time you've done this course.
It is. We did it last year. It was our first time, and we're hoping to do it annually.
How many people showed up last time?
Last year we had about 40, 45 people in attendance.
This next one is the 25th of June, a Saturday, from 9 a.m. till 2 p.m.
It is, yeah.
Do you have enough time to cover everything you want to cover? Or does it always seem like you're squishing time at the end?
No, I think we plan it pretty well. We have, in the workshop, we have four different panels that each cover a different sort of aspect of running for public office and working in a public office. And by public office, we mean, in the case of this workshop, a local public office, so assembly members, or Juno school board members.
What's the biggest concern for people who want to take the course?
I think it varies a lot from person to person. Last year we had a number of people that were taking the course that were concerned, for instance, about fulfilling all the legal requirements for candidacy, like going through the Alaska Public Offices Commission and all the paperwork associated with it. We had other candidates that were more interested and concerned about the time commitment that's involved in running for and in serving in a local public office. So it varies from person to person. Others wondered and had more thoughts and discussion around the aspect of running a campaign.
So you try to strip aside the glamour of being an assembly person.
We sure do. we like to get into the nitty-gritty details and help answer those questions that people have, yeah.
What percentage of people who take the course follow through and run for office?
What did we have last year? I think, you know, it's a relatively small percentage, but and I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but when we're promoting for the workshop, one of the things that we say is that, of course, people who are interested in running themselves for public office are a key target for us, but also people that are interested in helping other people run for public office, because you don't run on your own. It takes a team.
Why are you doing this? What kind of benefits are you getting yourself?
Well, so there's a couple of different groups that are planning this workshop. The library is one group, obviously, but also the Juno League of Women Voters is helping quite a bit, kind of organize and manage the effort, the Juno School District, the City Clerk's Office, and all of us share just making sure I'm not forgetting anyone, all of us share a common a mission of wanting to further civic education and participation in civic life and making democracy work. And so we see providing this workshop and helping people learn about what it means to be an assembly member and to be a school board member and possibly take that leap into putting their hat in the ring to serve in our public sphere here locally is one way in which we help fulfill and meet that mission.
And this is free.
It is free. We do it. Registration is required, so we can talk a minute about that. But it is free. The Friends of the Juneau Public Library sponsor the food that we go. So everyone that registers and comes, we feed them, and then we use the chambers at City Hall, where the assembly meets very, very frequently, to host it. And so then, other than staff time, there are very few costs associated with this program.
Do you do any role playing?
Any role play? No, you don't have to be scared about coming to do role play. It's a panelist type event. So we have four different panels. The first panel focuses on the job and what it means, what you do as an assembly member and a school board member. The second panel focuses on all the legal requirements of candidacy. The third one we call Campaigning 101. So it's all about how to run a campaign and what you might expect to spend on a campaign and the different options that are available to you from that perspective. And then the fourth one is about making the decision to run in the first place. You know, what are the things that you ought to consider when you're deciding whether or not to throw your hat in the ring? And so these panels are composed of current and former office holders, and as well as some city and school district representatives. So the superintendent and city manager, for example, are on the panels. And we have a moderator for each panel that asks questions of the panel that are prepared in advance. And then at the end of every panel, the audience has a time for Q&A.
What's been the reaction from people?
You know, people have been, I've only heard positive things in reaction to the program. Last year, we filled up very, very fast. And this year, we decided to lower the amount of people that we're accepting into the program to 30 instead of upwards of 40, 50 in order to allow for a more familiar, I guess, experience with the panelists and allow more time for Q&A because we didn't have nearly as much last year. And we just have a few spots left. So if you're listening and you're interested, now is the time to register. The registration forms are online at the League of Women Voters website. So if you go to www.junolwv.org, that will get you to the registration form. And again, I think we're down to just 5 seats left. We've got 25 people confirmed for the event.
Anything you'd like to add that I've forgotten to ask?
You know, I'd say that when you think about our government, you know, it's important at every level, of course. But from a local level, some of the decisions that are made at our local government level impact us more significantly sometimes than our state and federal decisions that are made. Not to say that those aren't important branches of government as well, but it's something that's important not to discount. And if you're listening to this, I'd really encourage you to give some thought to running for local office. And if you can't make the workshop, another good way to learn about what our local officials do is simply to attend their meetings. All of our assembly meetings and school board meetings are public meetings. They're open to the public. You can attend, you can watch, you can get a sense for what goes on at those meetings and the decisions and the ramifications, the decisions that our office holders are making on behalf of all of us.
After taking part in the workshop, are there any people who said, I'm not running?
Of course, yeah. Our fourth panel is called Making the Decision to Run, and we talk about what that means to run for office. And a lot of people, not a lot, but some people come to the workshop thinking, maybe I might want to run. But we recognize that the answer to that maybe question may very well be no. And it is, from our perspective, just as valuable for people to learn that about local office and about themselves as it is for them to say yes and think, I do want to run. There are, you know, depending on what your daytime profession is, some professions work better than others in local office. It's a huge time commitment. Our local officials dedicate a lot of their personal time to making sure our city and our schools run effectively.
I've been talking with Robert Barr from the library system about how to run for public office with this Saturday, June 25th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the Assembly Chambers. It's absolutely free. And how do you register again?
To register, go online to www.junolwv.org. you'll see a link on the front page right as it comes up to, for the registration form for this workshop.
All right. I'm assuming it's going to fill up in the next few minutes.
I would imagine so. I hope so.
All right. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you, Jeff.
Forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers. Forecast for Thursday, partly cloudy skies in the morning, then becoming sunny. Forecast for Thursday night, mostly cloudy skies with isolated showers in the evening. Decreasing clouds on Friday, increasing clouds on Friday night, mostly cloudy on Saturday and Sunday, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Live coverage of Celebration on 360 North and 360north.org begins at 6 p.m. tonight. Celebration coverage continues from 9 a.m. till 10 p.m. through Saturday. For more Celebration news coverage, go to ktmo.org/celebration. Tomorrow on a June afternoon, we'll be talking with Troy Quinn about the weekend Summer Pops concerts. We'll get a preview of this Thursday evening's Tiny Post Office concert. We'll get details about 4th of July activities, the Juneau Community Marching Band. Nancy and Cherney will be here at the Arts Hub. That Writer's Almanac, Burnout Music and More today, tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon, live at 4 with Karen Ann, on demand at ktmo.org.
water, motherhood, time, health food. What do these things have in common? They all have a history in America.
And it's this kind of history that we bring you each week on Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Ballow. Join us each week as we explore the surprising twists and turns in the story of how we got from there to here. Saturday afternoons at 3 on KTOO News, Juneau.
This is Kate.